Howard Kirschenbaum never intended to get involved in a multi-year campaign to amend the state's constitution, but that's where his love of the Adirondack Park took him in the late 70s and early 80s, eventually leading to the creation of a nonprofit group dedicated to promoting a better public understanding, appreciation, and stewardship of the region's unique and diverse architectural heritage. And on today's show, we're going to explore this chapter of Howard's life, which is documented in his new memoir, Coming of Age in the Baby Boom. I spoke with Howard on Thursday, and we began our conversation by discussing his introduction to the Adirondack Park.
Yeah, I guess it's been a relationship of about 55 years now. Friends of mine, Sid and Marianne Simon, had a farm in North Jay near Ausable Forks, and as a college student, when I got to know them, I came up to visit them at their place in the Adirondacks and just fell in love with it. I had a background in the Boy Scouts and loved the woods, and so within 2 years, I had found a little cabin in the woods without any phone or electricity north of Ausable Forks, and decided I'd move to the Adirondacks and live the life of like Thoreau. And it didn't work out quite like that, but it's been 50, 60 years now, and I still consider myself an Adirondacker and have made it a major part of my life.
Growing up on Long Island, did you ever venture that far north prior to that experience in college?
No, my family got as far as the Catskills. That was as much wilderness as my family knew, and went to some of those big resort hotels in the Catskills. So it was really through Boy Scouts that I kind of fell in love with the deeper woods and camping and so on. And Adirondacks was another order of wilderness beyond that.
So like I said at the top, what attracted me to your memoir is your involvement in amending the state's constitution, and more specifically, Article 14, where you can find the popular Forever Wild Clause. Can you talk about how your relationship with this portion of the state constitution began?
Well, I was director of Sagamore Lodge and Conference Center in Racket Lake, now known as Great Camp Sagamore, back in the 70s and 80s. And when we purchased the property from Syracuse University, the rest of Syracuse's acreage around Sagamore went to the State Forest Preserve. So that was fine, except that the half of the Sagamore complex, which ultimately became a National Historic Landmark, was the caretaking section of the camp. We had saved and we occupied and used the main family buildings and recreation buildings and dormitories and Great Main Lodge at Sagamore and dining hall. But where the caretakers lived, their residences, their workshops, the root cellar, the blacksmith shop, the barn, the carriage house, these were all on state land. And we learned that Article 14 of the state constitution required, as traditionally interpreted, required their removal because the forest preserve must be forever wild. And so after exploring every possible alternative to try to save the caretaking half of Camp Sagamore, and the more we learned about the great camps of the Adirondacks, the more we understood to have half a great camp where only the wealthy families lived and not the little village of buildings where the workers lived and practiced their craft, would not be to have a great camp at all. So I determined that the only way we would ever save these complex of buildings was to amend the state constitution to allow us to trade 200 acres of state, 200 acres of land to become part of the forest preserve in return for 10 acres and the caretaking buildings at Sagamore. So that was what we began a three-year campaign to accomplish just that, the amending of the state constitution to save the historic integrity of Sagamore.
How did you go about launching that campaign? Because I guess it's my understanding that at the time you weren't like a regular practitioner of Albany state government.
we found a friend of a friend who had worked for a legislator, and he gave me a seventh grade history lecture on how a bill becomes a law. And he explained how what we would have to do, we'd have to get it introduced and get legislators who would introduce it in the assembly and the Senate, and might have to go through about seven committees, and then it would pass the state legislature if the governor was willing to allow it to come out to the floor in the Democratic-controlled assembly. And then it would we'd have to do it again after a new state legislature was elected. And then it would go to all the voters of New York State to pass or not pass on as a public referendum. So we thought, well, I guess my reaction was, well, that's 10 or 15 or 20 steps. That's kind of like writing a grant, writing a book. We one chapter at a time. So that's what we did. We got some great allies. I went to the Adirondack Council, the leading environmental group then in the Adirondacks, and Gary Randolph, the executive director, who had lectured at Sagamore many times and loved the place, said sure they'd support it, and went to Paul Schaefer, the legendary head of secretary of the Association for the Protection of the Adirondacks, and he also recognized that historic preservation and conservation could go hand and should go hand in hand. And he said he'd support it. And Diana Waite, the executive director of the Preservation League of New York State, said they'd support it. And key figure in the Department of Environmental Conservation, Norman Van Valkenburg, felt it was on its merits. It made sense as well. So with that kind of backing, having those allies, we were able to go to Maurice Hinchey, who was then assemblyman, head of the Environmental Committee in the Assembly, and John Dunn in the Senate, and they agreed to co-sponsor the amendment. And that led to the beginning of the process of one person at a time, one group at a time, getting supporters both in the legislature and in the public to support the land exchange amendment.
So once you got the amendment approved, what was the ramifications of it? Did it work out the way you hoped?
It worked out beautifully. We found 245 acres that was surrounded by state land that we were able to trade to the state. It was a perfect acquisition for them because it eliminated that inholding within the private in this forest preserve. And we got the 10 acres. Sagamore Institute got the 10 acres and the caretaking buildings, and subsequently, over the years, Sagamore has turned that into a wonderful complex of buildings which are open for historic tours, and where blacksmiths and carpenters practice their craft, and that has additional housing for Sagamore staff members. So it really worked out perfectly. The state got an enhanced forest preserve. The buildings were saved, no cost to the state, and Sagamore has a great educational and recreational resource was enhanced.
In your book, you write about how you grew up with almost no exposure to minorities, but later became involved in the civil rights movement, including participating in the 1964 Mississippi Freedom Summer. So I'm curious what you think about efforts to promote diversity in the Adirondacks, which has had kind of a mixed bag recently, including the hiring of a director for an Adirondacks diversity initiative, but also seeing her move from her residence following the display of racist graffiti.
You would think traditionally the Adirondacks have seemed insulated from those cares of the rest of the world, but in some ways since George Floyd's murder, it's become a Adirondack issue as well. I was driving down the street in Tupper Lake one day this summer when I saw 50 people outside the town park demonstrating in support of Black Lives Matter. And I pulled the car over and joined the demonstration. And I've been to activities at John Brown's farm that reflect how the Adirondacks and many, many Adirondack residents have been deeply troubled by what they see in terms of some of the unwarranted police killings around the country. And so even here in the Adirondacks, I'm seeing quite many signs of concern and identification with the plight of minorities. I'm sure there's also concern about some of the violence in the cities, but for the most part, the demonstrations and protests in support of Black Lives Matter have been peaceful and in the best tradition of American democracy. And I think I think it's appropriate that in the Adirondacks we're dealing with it, we're coping with it, we're finding out that there's racism and prejudice up here as well, And many people, many town boards, like the Saranac Lake, where initially the town leaders didn't respond quickly enough and to the incident of racism against the new director of the Adirondack Diversity Initiative, they said publicly, we learned from it. You know, we were capable of growing. We're capable of being better than we have been. And so I'm taking it as a positive sign in the Adirondacks that we're dealing with these issues that the rest of the country is dealing with as well.
In recent years, the Adirondack Park has been enjoying unprecedented levels of visits, mostly to the high peaks, which is a blessing and a curse. Do you have any feelings about the best way to ensure this national treasure can be utilized by people today while still preserving that enjoyment of future generations?
Well, I think for the most part it's a positive thing, and that the overuse in certain places is a real issue, and we're facing up to it. I don't think there's any simple solution. I think DEC's current position is that they don't want to limit access through a permit system or as a first choice. They want to try relocating trails. They want to try educating visitors, and only as a last choice should they undertake restrictions on the public's use of the forest preserve. I think that's probably the right approach. So I don't have a definite opinion as to what the ultimate solution is. I think it'll be a combination of those efforts, and perhaps at some point there may need to be a permit system. And ironically, it's taken COVID to create some of this appreciation, but it's a positive thing that people are appreciating the value of outdoors and quiet spaces and beautiful spaces and safe spaces where people can, in small groups or on their own, experience nature. COVID has contributed to that, but I think it was happening anyway as the Adirondacks' popularity has increased in recent decades. I know when I became an Adirondack 46er, I think I was in the 6,000 of people who had climbed all 46 peaks of the Adirondacks, and in just the 12 years or so since then, it's doubled to over 12,000. So it's an indication of the Adirondacks' growing popularity statewide and even nationally.
Considering how you've taken an active role in working on Adirondack preservation, do you feel like the cause of preservation is heading in the right direction when it comes to the Adirondack Park?
Yes and no. When I started Adirondack Architectural Heritage, the nonprofit historic preservation organization for the Adirondack Park back in 1990, the initial board and I felt it was very important that historic preservation and environmental conservation be seen as allied endeavors. They could go hand in hand, that they shouldn't be in conflict with one another, that it's possible to have some wonderful historic buildings in and at the edges of the forest preserve while still keeping the integrity of the Adirondack Forest Preserve intact. And I think we've succeeded over the 30 years of ARCH's existence in helping public appreciate the historic and architectural, cultural resources that we have in the Adirondacks. And so there's been a great appreciation and support for many historic preservation activities, where sometimes there's still some conflict that we have to walk a fine line of balance between is where we have buildings in the State Forest Preserve or controlled by New York State, like Camp Santinoni or DeBar Pond Lodge or Camp Comfort on Lake Colby, where we're still struggling between trying to figure out how to save and utilize these resources in the public interest and not simply have them torn down and removed. And DeBar Pond Lodge would be my best example right now of where it may be another land exchange amendment is needed to find a way to both enhance the forest preserve and save an incredible Adirondack Lodge that could be appreciated and enjoyed by so many people. You know, it's always been a balancing act in the Adirondacks of utilizing the wilderness, saving historic buildings, having a solid economy, and trying to figure out in each instance what's the best way to achieve all those values is tricky, and that continues in the Adirondacks, but I think we're on the right track.
I'm curious then whether you have any thoughts on the sale of the Whitney Park property, about 36,000 acres. Any thoughts on how you think that should be handled?
Well, my guess is it's going to be handled just as it was when the state acquired over 10,000 acres of the Whitney Preserve in the past, is that the family will put it on the market, ask for a huge amount of money for it, more than it's worth, and in the end, the state will find a way to pay a bit less and acquire it for the Forest Preserve. That's my guess is what's going to happen.
We've been speaking with Howard Kirschenbaum, author of Coming of Age in the Baby Boom, a memoir of personal development, social action, education reform, and Adirondack preservation. Howard, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks very much, Dave. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Capitol Press Room, which you can take with you on the go wherever you download podcasts. Our engineer in Syracuse is Dave White. My producer in Albany is Tim Williams. I'm David Lombardo. Thanks for listening.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.